Thank you.
All right. Well, welcome. It's my great pleasure to welcome David Karger from MIT CSAIL to Microsoft Research. David was my graduate advisor and also a longtime mentor and friend. He started his career thinking in theory, thinking a lot about algorithms, and particularly interested in algorithms that have real-world impact. An example of this is Akamai, which is a company that he helped found. More recently, he's been thinking a lot about how to help people organize and share and manage information, and that's what he's going to be talking about today. During his talk, I encourage you to ask good questions. I'll be on ResNet on the chat for those of you online if you want to ask questions as well. One of my favorite things about David is he has this really amazing ability to watch things and distill them and come up with questions that really get to the heart of things, and so I think we could try and put that, you know, return the courtesy. So thank you.
Thanks very much. It's really fun to be back. I haven't visited for a while, so this was a good excuse. Now, I know that some of you know some of this work, but hopefully there's enough new stuff in here to keep you interested. This is a kind of broad and thus shallow talk covering a lot of different projects that we've done that all share a common theme. I chose to do that rather than diving into something deeply because, well, I'm going to be here all day and I'd love to talk to anybody who's interested about any of the specific projects that I mentioned, and we can go into as much greater depth as you're interested in. And this way, I put out as the maximum possible number of lures this way to attract people to talk to me. So in case anybody needs to leave early, I always like to start with the conclusion of my talk, which is that I believe that people are really quite good at managing information in many different ways. They know a lot, they understand a lot, they have very interesting ways of organizing and visualizing and explaining the information they work with. And that far too often, the problem is not the people, but the tools that they're using, which straitjacket them into very particular ways of working with information that don't let them express everything that they know and understand and wish to share. And this is not a computational problem. This is not something that can be solved with machine learning. You need to get the information from the person into the computer. And so this is really about expanding the interfaces and the models of information that are in our systems to represent what people are thinking. And if we do that, then we don't need sophisticated computation because that is provided by the people. And I think that there are many ways we can do this, and I'm going to be talking in sort of two main pieces in this talk. First, about text, sort of online discussion systems, and how to be more expressive in text. And then I'm going to turn to structured data and information visualization and online applications, which are another way that I think end users can express themselves well. So just to sort of, you know, hammer this a little pictorially, I really think that a lot of times what goes on is that person has very rich, sophisticated picture in their minds, and what the computer lets them draw is this. We then throw a huge amount of computation at the stick figure in order to figure out exactly what the user meant. But there just isn't a lot of information in a stick figure. And no matter how much information, how much computation you apply, you're still not going to get what the user was thinking. To sort of localize this a little bit, you know, how does web search, how does question answering happen on the web these days? Well, you go to Bing and you type in, according to the latest distribution, a couple of words in order to answer your question. Now, that's what we've gotten used to in computers, in sort of asking the web, asking computers. But as people like Mary and Jamie have studied, right, when you ask people, you do it a different way. You tend to have very long descriptions of your information need, what you're asking. This is Quora. You know, the typical question is a sentence, but it then unpacks into a paragraph underneath. And sometimes people have so much to ask that they put their own comment on their question in order to give the three-paragraph explanation of what it is that they're actually asking. And anybody is capable of doing that, right? People are not limited in their minds to stating two words about their question, but that is what we steer them to with the interfaces that we provide. You can see this all the way back in the ancient days of TREC, right? The text retrieval evaluation systems. you know, they had short queries, behavioral genetics, but the description of what you needed took a paragraph. And we still don't really write systems where you describe your information need that way, unless you're talking to other people. So as I said, this has been recognized here, like the, right? So in the Stuff I've Seen project and FLAT and so forth, there was this work to try and enrich the way you could describe the information that you're looking for, also in the social search work that I just mentioned. Now today I'm not really going to be talking about query systems, but I'm going to be talking about systems for capturing and sharing information, which of course, if you can get that information in, then it becomes something that you can use to retrieve. So the outline. I'm going to argue that these rich information and models and interfaces empower people to share. And I'm going to be looking first at text. And I'm going to talk about three tools, one of which allows you to use annotation as a way to discuss material in online education. Then I'm going to talk about collaborative summarization of discussions. And finally, I'm going to touch briefly on managing attention more explicitly through better mailing list systems. Then I'll turn to data, and I'll first talk about letting end users create information visualizations, and then I will talk about end user application building, and somehow I'm going to finish all of this in 50 minutes. So act one is text. So online discussion today consists of streams of posts, comments, and replies. We see this everywhere, on Twitter, on news site, comment boards, on YouTube, on Facebook, on Reddit. All of these systems collect huge amounts of comments, right? Hundreds are typical on Reddit or CNN, thousands. This particular video on YouTube has over 500,000 comments on it. Now, all of these systems are pretty much the same. They have pretty much the same impoverished model of you can post something, you can reply to something, maybe you can tag, you can follow specific people, you can like things. And that's about it. It's a linear stream of these comments, maybe with threading. And then there's, because it's so massive, there's this often opaque way of selecting which content is actually going to be shown to you. We understand majority voting, and that's still used in places like Reddit. Of course, majority voting has problems if you're not in the majority. And then there are much more opaque systems like the Facebook feed and trending topic things where you have no idea why certain things are being shown to you, but just something shows up by magic. The result is information overload, and I think on a lot of these sites, you end up with write-only comment streams where everybody sort of says what they want but doesn't actually consume anything that anybody else said. And sadly, this is recognized that comments just don't work very well, and all sorts of important sites are turning off their comment systems for lack of any utility, or sadly, in the case of popular science, by recognizing that they're actually harming the cause of science. So I'd like to show a few ways that I think commenting can be improved, or rather online discussion in general. So the first is some Chi 2012 work that we did on discussion in the margins. This is a general idea, but we aimed it at online education because that is a place where often there is a group of people who want to talk about something. Right? There's a textbook, there's lecture notes, there are primary sources, and you want to talk about those. Now, classroom discussion forums are a fine way to do that. Students can ask questions, and it's nice. They don't have to ask them in class. They can ask them whenever they have them. They can get answers from other students and staff. It produces this nice archival record of questions and answers, and the faculty can observe this and have, you know, you don't get many questions in class, but by looking over the forum, you might be able to get a sense of what's confusing, what needs to be taught better or edited. But discussion forums happen out of context, right? Whatever it is that you're reading, you have to stop reading it and go to the discussion forum. And while you're at it, you may do a few other things because you've lost your focus. When you're in the forum, well, the answer to your question might be somewhere, but you don't know exactly where. You have to wade through the entire forum, maybe use some of that very limited search. You have to describe then, if you want to ask a question, the context of your question. You may be able to hunt around for questions you can answer, but there's no sort of guidance of where you should look. And for the faculty who's trying to figure out what's going on, they just see a big pile of posts and don't have a general sense of understanding. So what we chose to do was to use the course content itself as a context and keep that context during the discussion by having discussions in the margins of the material being discussed. So NB is a standard threaded discussion tool, just like any forum, but it happens in the margins of the documents that are part of the class. The faculty signs up the class, invites students, puts in PDFs or HTML or YouTube videos. Students can then discuss all of that stuff by highlighting the content they want to talk about, entering comments, and replying to existing comments. Yes? Nota bene.
Nota bene.
It's just a mark that you put about sort of something you want to add to the additional that you want to say. Yes.
So for the document you're talking about here with marginalia, mm-hmm. What does that mean for video?
It means you actually highlight a place and a time in the video, right? So as the video is playing, you get to a certain spot and you can sort of, you know, drag a rectangle over a spot in the video at that place. And there's nothing clever about it. It doesn't like follow objects or anything. It's just this place. It's just a three-dimensional coordinate. And then as you play back, those things pop up at the appropriate time. I'm not showing video here. I'm showing annotation of a PDF document, which was the first thing that we supported. You can see a pretty typical threaded discussion forum on the right, but it's associated with this content. And you see all these little rectangles around different parts of the content. Each of these comments is associated with a rectangle. This one, I think, is particularly telling because the question is, how did we get three from one? And can you imagine putting that into a normal discussion forum and having it mean anything? Right? So the context to this question is critical. Right? But once you have the context, the question meaning is completely clear. Right? So when you see a question like this, as you're reading, you can hit reply. It opens up, again, in a typical way, a box where you can hit a reply and submit, and it goes into the thread. So benefits of this. Yes?
I noticed reply requested there as being an option.
Yes.
That's uncommon, right? What made you so what does that mean?
Well, so there's a bunch of features in here that we added sort of driven by the educational sort of the particular structure of this discussion forum, right? So in these discussion forums, there are a lot of posts that people make where they are just sort of saying something, right? They're like, I want to express my insight about this. I think this is funny. I think this is interesting, so on and so forth. But in the classroom, something that happens a lot is somebody doesn't understand something. And so we wanted a way to flag that. Because now when you go to the dashboard of NB, you can actually say which are the comments for which replies have been requested. This also can guide the faculty, right? If there's a question that's been outstanding for a while and a reply hasn't been given, they can intervene. On that question. So benefits. You have the discussion as you read without exiting the document. You can stay in the flow of the discussion. Also, as you're reading, you can see in the margins what are the questions about the thing you're reading now. So it's just the right time for you to be seeing those comments and not the other comments. You can see other people's insights to help you. You can see other people's questions, and you've just read the material they're asking questions about, so you're perfectly situated to answer those questions. The context is clear, as we just saw. There's no need to explain the question or understand from the question what they're asking. There's also this nice fact that the annotations form a heat map of the trouble spots. And I moved my slide somewhere, but I'll show you our heat map in a little while. Now, this is not a new idea. This is the Babylonian Talmud, which was written about 2,000 years ago. Or rather, I should say that this portion was written about 2,000 years ago. And then people had conversations about it a few hundred years later, and they annotated that portion with some discussion. And then a few hundred years after that, people came along and annotated the annotations. And a few hundred years after that, people came in and annotated the annotations on the annotations. So annotation has been around for a while. More recently, Don Knuth came out with a lovely book called Concrete Mathematics. And this book, he handed out drafts to the students. They wrote in the margins. And he said, oh, these are interesting things. I'll publish what they wrote. And he actually curated their comments and stuck all the good ones into the book. And this makes one of the most fun books to read that I've ever seen, because it's full of the voices of the students saying, ooh, this, you know, you may not understand why he's talking about this now, but just wait three pages, and then it'll be great. Or, you know, sort of throwing in bad jokes about some of the material, like all sorts of stuff that wouldn't make any sense in the text itself, but is wonderful in the margins. Now, even, yes?
Have you ever read the book S.
S.
S. That's the title of the book. It
As in
not,
eat?
Just the letter S.
Oh, okay.
It came out a few years ago. It's written by the guy J.J. Abrams who made Lost, but the whole book is written as if it's a book, like the library, a library book called Ship of Theseus, and then the story, so there's the primary text, and
yes.
the story is all printed in the margins
oh,
of
cool.
discussions of students from the college library who are reading the book and leaving notes for each other.
That's wonderful.
Read it, don't read the ebook. Get the physical
yes,
book.
Yes,
yes. I think
that
you
sounds
all,
wonderful.
Yes.
All right. So, right here at Microsoft, about 10 years ago, A.J. Brush and others did a project on this kind of annotation in the classroom. And they did pretty much what we did, discussion forum in the margins. But they were limited by the technology of the time. They had to use a browser extension to provide the functionality. There was no pervasive Wi-Fi. Screens were not as fun to work with. So what they found was that people printed out their documents and they read them. And then because they were required to annotate, they would like mark up the paper. And then they would come back to where there was internet and they would re-enter their annotations on the system. And so this slowed everything down tremendously. And they had to actually introduce like a forced cycle where, you know, on day one you had to enter an annotation and on day two you had to reply to an annotation. And so it just wasn't organic. And so I don't think we really changed very much in the system, but the times have changed. And so things came out much better for us. So looking at the assessment, at this point, NB is in use in about 700 classes around the world at 60 universities. These are traditional classes. I know of only one hybrid MOOC that we worked with, but no actual MOOCs. Nevertheless, in these classes, about 60,000 students have made comments, and we've broken a million comments in the system. It's on all sorts of topics, and there's frequent reuse by faculty. It's been growing in usage year by year since we released it. I've split out over here because in 2015, UC Davis started using it for a 1,000 student biology class, and the result is that they're now almost half of the volume of the system. Yes?
Did you do anything special to kind of evangelize it?
No, this is entirely word of mouth.
Put it out on your website. And
we put it out. We did it in a few sites at MIT. We did it at a couple of places at Harvard, and since then we haven't done anything. Now, one of the people we work with at Harvard was Eric Mazur, who's sort of led the flipped classroom movement. And I think he has sort of talked about it in certain places and encouraged people to use it. But I think most of the people are just stumbling across it one way or another. These are the places that are using it with the sort of amounts of commenting that they have. So you know, lots of American universities, but also English language learning institute in Algeria, Zurich, Korea, Japan. Of course, I can't read their annotations, so I don't know what they're using it for, but they're using it. And these are the classes that it's being taught. And again, this is just to show you a range of subjects. We've got anthropology, Shakespeare, material science, psychology, philosophy, physics, chemistry. You know, all of these courses have content, and so they have things that you want to talk about. I'm going to focus, because this is what we evaluated in 2012, on a particular class that was taught at MIT on the art of approximation in science and engineering. This was taught by Sanjay Mahajan, who became sort of yes.
Yeah, before you go into the detail, yeah. I'm wondering, this is another overview question about the stuff you're doing. Is there a kind of media that seems to be most popular and most effectively used with this, like PDFs mostly or web?
Right. So when we launched this tool, it was PDF only. A few years later, we added HTML and video only last year. And so the vast majority of users use PDFs. I think that is exacerbated by the fact that our instructions haven't changed since we launched the thing. And so you have to actually find out that it can support HTML and YouTube videos. The UC Davis people, though, are using it for HTML. And that's getting very heavy usage. So at this point, you know, probably half of our comments are on HTML. Video has, I'm still sort of hunting for the right groups. I'm actually in talks with a bunch of dance choreographers who may use it to sort of annotate rehearsals and things. In terms of the content, I find that it generally seems to work better with dense content. We had some early users who tried to do annotations on slides, and somehow it just didn't work. There wasn't enough material per page to drive anything interesting. I'm still not sure why. So just documents is what usually works. And that's what was used here. In this class, Sanjay was so heavily involved in this that we ultimately made him a co-author on the paper. He was very excited to use NB because he'd already had students annotating paper copies of his textbook and handing in all of the annotated copies so that he could revise it for the following year. So he was very open to this idea. He required annotation. But he never said how much was required. And over the course of the semester, the amount of annotation that students were doing doubled on a sort of lecture-by-lecture basis. So to me, this means that they were moving beyond the requirement and doing this voluntarily because it was providing value to them. But of course, we can't prove that. There were extensive in-depth discussions, and we found that the majority of questions raised by students were being resolved by other students within an hour. This was a class of about 100 students. There's sort of the expected long-tail distribution of discussion lengths. This is a log plot, so most discussions are short. There were many discussions per page, a reasonably large number of posts per discussion, and quite a few long discussions on every page. In terms of the content types, about a quarter of the material was substantive commentary, where students would observe something interesting about the text. Another third was serious questions about either the concepts or the meaning of the text. And then a fifth was answers, mostly by students, a small amount by the faculty. And then there was a bunch of humor and anecdotes and stuff. In terms of the question resolutions, most of the time they were resolved in the same thread, but one thing that I found really interesting was that 10% of the time students answered a question in a different thread. And this really wouldn't make sense in a traditional discussion forum because threads are independent of one another. But once you've got geography, you can say things like, well, that next door neighbor thread was saying X, and so I am going to respond to sort of relate how this discussion thread and this discussion thread connect to each other. What did users say? Well, students talked about how they had never had this level of in-depth discussion before, and they were able to exploit the collective intelligence of the class in order to understand the material. They liked the measuring stick that told them how other students in the class were also confused, and they didn't have to feel bad about themselves. Faculty, in general, were very satisfied with the tool. They felt the quality of the comments was very high, and they generally intend to reuse the tool. And this is all despite the fact that this was really not a very well-written system. It was buggy. The interfaces were not designed according to good principles. It just had the functionality, and you suffered through the necessity of using it. Faculty thought it was wonderful that they could know their students. They felt that students were much more engaged in discussion in this tool than they were in the classroom. And even the shy ones who didn't want to speak up in person seemed able to speak on this system. And they felt much more connected to the students. They felt that the quality of the online discussion was much better than they were able to do in a classroom and much better than they were able to do on any other forum. Nevertheless, a lot of these comments would be comments that would be appropriate to say about any faculty member who introduced an online discussion forum in their class. Was there anything different about NB? Well, many people had tried forums before and failed, and something about NB made it work. And the only really different thing about NB was the fact that it's happening in the margins. So we can't say that we didn't do a controlled experiment with a standard discussion forum. But it seems to me that that's the likely explanation for what worked here, is that people were just being guided more effectively to the discussions that they could participate in. There were things that were pointed out that were very specific to NB, like the fact that you could see which areas students were confused about by seeing where the comments were dense. And you could see where they were not understanding something, and you could then focus in on that in follow-on lectures. So this is a heat map presentation that you could get in order to see where the comments are, and that helped guide faculty towards the problems. They also felt that this turned around and improved the in-class discussion. That's how students were reading more and more involved with the text when they showed up to class, and so the discussions could be deeper and more thought-provoking. I think that what's going on there is that this usual thing that when you measure something, it gets optimized. So for the first time, students could see that for the first time, faculty could see where students were engaging with the text. Students knew that the faculty were seeing where they were engaged with the text, and so now they were motivated to engage with the text. Another sort of thing that you can observe is the fact that most of the students never printed their notes. We could tell because you had to download them in order to print them, and they didn't do it. So they were all reading online, despite the fact that we know that paper is a better reading experience. So something about having the discussion forum worked better. Another thing that we did was we logged the annotation activity, and we discovered, unlike WebAnn, where people came back and annotated later. This is the distribution of when during their reading session did students perform annotation. And you can see that all the annotation is happening all throughout the reading session, not at the end when you go back and do your assignment. So people were really reading and annotating at the same time. So that's the summary of the annotation work. Yes?
Do the annotations ever reset?
That's a very interesting question, and let me do the short answer, and we can talk about this at the end, but the faculty, when they start a new class, there's an obvious question. Should I keep the old class's annotations or not? And I think that in general, it is a good idea not to, because of research in the education literature, which shows the value of learning through discussion. So you don't want a big set of answers that the students can read and be done. You want a place where students can ask questions and engage in discussion and come to their own answers, and that has been proven to help them learn better than just reading. And we've actually added some functionality to support that even better by selecting out comments that can that we believe will generate good discussion. And I'll have to push that off to the end so that I can get through some other stuff in the meantime. So where are we taking this next? Well, I just actually mentioned this. Seeding of discussions in order to stimulate student discussion. So we throw away most stuff, but there's some stuff that we found if we keep it, it causes students to have more discussions. And so we've done some experiments on that. We think there need to be even better faculty analytics, and so we're working now on like tagging to let students say I'm confused or I'm interested or this is boring, and we're trying to figure out ways to present that to faculty to help them improve their own content. And as I said, we've just begun work on annotation of video lectures. All right, moving on to topic two, collaborative summarization. Yes?
Comment, I don't know if you've thought about it, but in addition or instead of the dance videos, you could also think about film study for football teams. You know, you at least have Boston College there. You have some other ones right around, right? There's a lot of film study done, and it's a very different population.
That would be really cool, but given the amount of money in that industry, I bet they already have far better tools than we can provide them. I don't know. I have to see if I can find somebody in sports.
That coaches will know what players are studying. You'll have a very different thing.
Very interesting. All right, something for me to take back. So, yes.
On the video annotation, along with the WebAnn that we did a whole lot, you may know this, but we did a whole lot more on the MRAS system with video annotation.
Oh, actually, I don't know about MRAS. I should read about it.
That was my favorite project from that era, and we could have a discussion because it was video lectures primarily.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
We have years of work on it. It was used over UW in classes much more successfully than WebAnn.
Great. Great, yes. So let's talk about it. Yes, Celine Latulipe also has some work on video annotation that for dance choreography, actually, that I've read up a little on. All right, let me see what else I can get through in my hour. So collaborative summarization. So this aims directly at this problem of just volume. There's too much stuff. And so, you know, we do filtering and such. But still require people to really wade through the entire conversation in order to understand it. This can be hard to follow. There can be too much volume. We want to do better than filtering. And an obvious alternative is some kind of summarization, right? There's been a bunch of work in, let me push that off. So we want to create textual summaries, but if you're talking about 500,000 comments, there's just no way that a person can create a textual summary of 500,000 comments. But maybe if a group of people could collaborate on creating a summary of something complicated that would reduce the workload to something tolerable. And this is what happens in wikis. You've got all of those encyclopedia articles on Wikipedia, which have been written by a group of people. And there have been efforts on places like Quora to use answer wikis to summarize all of the discussions of answers to questions. These wikis, though, they've lost all of the original discussion, right? They're a summary, but they're not anchored in the discussion itself. So you have no idea how much has been summarized, whether there's new stuff that needs to be incorporated, and it really only gives you one level of detail. So we've created a tool called Wikim, which tries to create a bridge between wikis and discussion forums. The idea is that you start with a long discussion, and then anyone reading a section of that discussion can write a summary of just that section. And this summary then replaces that section of the discussion with something shorter. And of course, now that it's been replaced, the next person who's reading is going to read a mixture of comments and summaries, and they may summarize a mixture of comments and summaries to make things even shorter. And so each person who comes in summarizes a little bit and shortens things up a little bit more. So we've got our interface sort of tries to make this easy, to let you sort of select a small thread or set of comments, group them together, and then write a summary of it. Now, because of this sort of summarizing of summaries of summaries, you end up not with just a single summary, but what we call a summary tree, okay, which has many, many levels of detail, right? Eventually, you've summarized down so that the whole discussion is just one short summary, but that summary was made by summarizing some slightly more detailed summaries. And you can imagine unpacking and sort of saying, I want more detail about this particular piece of the top-level summary, so I will dive down into a more detailed summary of that particular piece. And so you don't just have a summary, you have sort of a map of the entire discussion. So compared to a traditional wiki, the Wikim interface lets you see the current state of summarization of the entire discussion. It also links summaries to the particular pieces of discussion that they summarize. So you can quote particular things that you've summarized or cite particular things that you've summarized, and people can use that to navigate into more detail. And so it creates helpful summaries at multiple levels. You can try this yourself. I'll have links to all of these tools at the end of the talk, but they're all up online for you to play with. This is a picture of the interface, a sort of a tree view on the left, summaries on the right, and a box for writing your own summary, which provides ways of selecting what you want to summarize, finding isolated trees, clustering comments together that may summarize well, highlighting particular sections that you want to pull into your summary, filtering comments in various ways to find good ones to summarize. Then we provide ways for you to create actually an above-the-fold summary of your summary. And as I said, citing of paragraphs, commenting, and quoting. We do a little bit of machine learning to try and help you do your summary, but it really didn't work very well, so this is almost entirely manual. How do we evaluate this? Well, we wanted to evaluate both the summarization process and the usefulness of the resulting summaries. So our first study was to evaluate summarization itself. We got a bunch of participants, and we had them spend an hour summarizing a bunch of online discussions that we found, one from The Atlantic, one from Reddit, and one from Popular Science, I believe. I can't remember what that third one was. And we gave them two tools for summarization. One was Wikim, and the other was a wiki in the form of Google Docs. We had each people do summarization in both modes to balance out the experiment. And each person built on the work done by previous people in the group. All the discussions had about 100 comments, 8,000 words, and took about 40 minutes to read, so people were not reading the whole thing. They didn't have time in the time that we gave them. Yes, and these are the three pieces. This is what it looked like starting in Wikim. We pasted the whole thing into Google Docs as well. This is what it looked like partially complete in Wikim, showing both summaries and original content. This is what it looked like in Google Docs, where they would sort of color code in various ways. And as you can see, it's already kind of clear that this is going to be painful to work with. These are the results. We looked at sort of summarization rates. how quickly they were able to summarize the content down to essentially nothing. The solid lines are Wickham, and the dashed lines are Google Docs. And you can, at least visually, it appears that Google Docs sort of asymptoting, that at a certain point, you just can't summarize anymore. The problem was, there were a bunch of problems. One was that people were very reluctant to edit each other's work. And in Google Docs, this is kind of the only way that you could improve the summary. Whereas in Wickham, since you were overlaying your summary on the previous content, you weren't changing what they had, you were just adding. And so people were much more eager to do that. People had needed a lot more time to read to figure out what was going on in the Google Doc. Norms were set very early about how long summaries should be and what sort of tone they should take. In Google Doc, there was less convergence, I think, because it was harder to see what had already been done. They also, this was just sort of unrelated, but people had reported having a lot of trouble summarizing content that they disagreed with, which is perhaps not surprising, but something that is going to have to be addressed if people are going to be using summaries. People found that using Wickham was much easier. They got lost in the Google Doc because there was no real good way to hide the stuff that they didn't want to see. They found it very useful to be able to cite and quote and understand where pieces of the summary were coming from. With Google Docs, they felt overwhelmed by the need to summarize everything, whereas Wickham sort of steered them into a small section, and they felt, of course I can summarize 10 comments down to a single summary. In our second evaluation, we evaluated the summarization output. So here we brought in a bunch of people who were not involved in writing the summaries, and we asked each of them to spend a short amount of time reading a summary in Wickham and a short amount of time reading a summary in Google Docs and also reading the unsummarized discussion. And we then gave them questions about the material. Essentially, we had these very large discussions. We had them summarizing only half of the discussion. So we were able to select topics that were in the part that was summarized and also select topics that were not in the part that was summarized. And we essentially asked them whether these topics had been discussed in the part of the discussion that was summarized. And people generally reported that it was easier to work with Wickham in order to answer these questions, and they tended to answer the questions more quickly. We found that people did remember things more accurately in Wickham, but we didn't have a large enough population to assert statistical significance on the results. We saw different strategies. Some people really liked to dive deeply into specific parts of the summary. Other people had this sort of breadth-first exploration where they would expand everything at a particular level and work down. Some people really like to just read linearly, and others really like to drill down. People had different reasons for unpacking a summary. Sometimes they were intrigued by it and wanted more detail. Other times they just didn't trust it because it was poorly written or too short. They felt that the summaries in Wickham were more useful. Again, I think Google Doc just didn't provide enough control over how you wrote the summaries, and so the result was something of a mess. So they ended up just going down to the original comments. Now, when we submitted this, one of our reviewers said, this was a terrible experiment because Google Docs is a terrible tool for doing these sorts of summaries. And our answer was, yes, that's the point, right? That right now there are no good tools for helping people construct summaries of discussions. And we just wanted to verify that if you gave people a good tool, they could do something better. And I think we demonstrated that. So looking forward again, we're revising the interface based on what we observed. We want to provide people with more context and help them find sections that they want to summarize. We want to do a better job of handling unthreaded discussions. So threading gives you some starting organization, so you can summarize a whole thread. If you just have a bunch of unrelated posts, we're probably going to want to do some machine learning to gather the posts on a particular topic so that you can summarize them as a group. We also need to deal with the fact that sometimes threading is a lie, and people post things that don't have anything to do with what they're replying to. And so we need to actually let people break off chunks of discussion and say they belong somewhere else. We also want to blend this sort of summarization with the discussion process itself. So you shouldn't have to summarize after the discussion happened. You should be able to summarize while it's going on in real time. And then people may want to reply to summaries, right, as opposed to replying to original threads. We also found that sometimes people made terrible summaries, and we need ways for people to say, this is a terrible summary, it should be replaced, or here's a competing summary, vote to decide which one you think is better. And we're starting with field experiments. We've sort of set up a collaboration with the Wikimedia Foundation. We're looking at some of the discussions that are happening in Wikipedia and seeing if this kind of tool can help them boil out the substance of the discussion. And surprisingly, given what I've just talked to you about, I also want to integrate this with annotation. So summarization is kind of taking a whole bunch of stuff and mushing it together. Annotation is kind of splitting out a tiny piece of things and saying, I want to focus in on that. I think they complement each other very nicely. So at this point, we've looked at two ways of organizing discussions, annotation and summarization. If you think about it, both of these are just special cases of hypertext, right? And I've been wondering, like, what happened to hypertext, right? So we have these artifacts like Wikipedia, which use some kind of hypertext, but it's promised, like, where did it go? Like, there's a hypertext conference, but it's not, like, everywhere on the web, despite all of the things you seem to be able to do with it. Now, both annotation and summarization provide a lot more structure than general hypertext. They avoid this sort of lost in hyperspace problem, because you have context, right? With annotation, you're centered on a specific piece of content. With summarization, you have a tree, and you're moving up and down in the tree. But maybe there's more we can do with richer models of hypertext, right? So in the law class that used NB, the students wanted to annotate the annotations, right? So how can we support that? What sort of interfaces will let you do something sensible without getting lost in hyperspace, right? With summarization, you often want summarization from multiple perspectives, where a particular comment may want to be in two places in the summary tree. So now it's not a tree anymore. It's some sort of DAG. How do you represent that and let people navigate it? I'm also interested in sort of more structuring of the discussion so that you can say, you know, this refutes that, or this is evidence for that. And again, how do you capture that and present it to users in effective ways? All right. Time. So that's an end of sort of structuring discussion. Any? Yes?
Could you just talk a little bit about the ideas you have for some of the quality control stuff? Because I think in the case of summarization more so than annotation,
yes,
that's a really, really sensitive
thing. I agree. Now, we do have a lot to draw from by looking at wikis, right? Because they're already dealing with this problem of large numbers of people who may disagree about how you do the summary, right? So Wikim is a wiki structure. It's just got more sort of structure inside of it to unpack the details. But that means I think we can lift out pretty much everything that's done in the wiki models, right? You want versioning so that people can roll back problems. You need ways of discussing the summary, so talk pages, maybe annotation on a summary to say that it's not good. You may need some kinds of social moderation, voting to say this is a better summary or this is a worse one. But I think there's a lot to do. It's very rich question. Okay. Yes?
Could you go back one second? So the bottom where you talk about the structure of discussion, are you thinking of doing something almost like akin to what the coordinator tried for email for discussion?
Yes. Yes. I mean, again, so for me, this is very much about representation. So I'm certainly not thinking about doing any kind of automation of, you know, this is not the AI. This is really just about representing it explicitly so that people can say, you know, show me the things that have not been refuted, right? Or erase the stuff that has been refuted so that I can focus in on the stuff that still needs to be discussed. Or, you know, these two things seem to be in contradiction. Let me ask about that. So, or let me post a contradiction flag so that somebody else can come in and explain what's going on. All right. Last thing I want to say about discussion, I really want to run through. It's just to say that it's not only about structure. We did a study of mailing lists as a complement, as a contrast to online discussion tools. Why are mailing lists still here, given all of these new online discussion tools that we've discovered that are now popular? And why do, even though they're still here, why do people complain about them all the time? And how can we fix them? So it sort of there's this nice complementarity between mailing lists and online discussion tools, and we can use them to understand each the other. So email began in 1967. And in 1971, the first mailing list was formed in order to discuss mailing lists. Mailing lists have not changed essentially at all in 40 years. And why is this? right? So there have certainly been all of these new tools that came out for discussion, as we've been discussing, but mailing lists haven't changed. There's so many new tools. Not many things have stayed the same for 40 years. So there must be something that's quite good about mailing lists, and we want to understand why they're still here. They must be better in some ways. But if they're better, why do we have these more modern tools? They must also be better in some ways. Can we combine the good bits? And what we've been focusing on is importing some of the ideas from social media into email, and I'll explain why in a second. This was an interview study, and I'm just going to zoom through this so that I can get to data for at least a few minutes. The result summary was basically that the vast majority of people, when offered the chance to switch from a mailing list to some sort of social media tool, said no way. They found that mailing lists were better for serious discussion. They thought that it was better to have the sort of privacy of only people on the mailing list seeing the discussion. They had a lot more confidence that if they posted something, it would be seen by participants. And they really appreciated the greater flexibility in how they managed what was coming at them, that they could write their own automatic filtering rules, they could decide the order in which to read things, so on and so forth. However, there was significant dissatisfaction, and this was primarily caused by the tensions between the senders and the receivers, right? So there was a lot of disagreement on a list about what were the right types of content for the list or what quantity of content should go on the list. A lot of people wanted more discussion to happen but were hesitant to post because they were afraid that other people did not want more discussion. And there was this real tension between these ideas that attention is precious. You don't want to hit people with too much. And the idea that, well, publish and filter, which is sort of a Clay Shirky aphorism that says, you know, you just put it out there and the machines will take care of figuring out who should see what, which I think is a terrible idea. And people's continued reliance on mailing lists shows that it is a terrible idea.
Towards using social media, did you first have some qualification questions that asked them whether or not they were aware about creating private groups and the ability to
Yes.
actually set them up in the first place?
We discussed these things with people, but honestly, despite their awareness of these things, they didn't use them very much. And I think it's, again, because of the poor interfaces and models that are provided for making use of these groups. And it was extreme. It was like only 10% of people were interested in shifting. Of course, there's some selection because these were people on mailing lists. But they really saw value in having that mailing list.
Yeah, I think it could be a generational thing, too. Like, are the people who are already using mailing lists?
Well,
you didn't say a group of 19-year-olds.
Well, we did do the study with a group of 19-year-olds. One of the two mailing lists that we did it with 19-year-olds who do not go to MIT. One of our two mailing lists was a mailing list of a large research laboratory, but the other mailing list where we interviewed and surveyed people was a dorm mailing list at a different university. So these were college students, very, very active on social media, but they loved their dorm mailing list. Can we fix some of the problems while not losing the appeal of mailing lists? Well, maybe we should just fix social media instead, because that has a lot of good things. But I think fixing email is more promising. The nice thing about fixing email is that we don't have to build necessarily a new user interface, because people already have email clients. Right, so we have less building to do. These email clients can also be chosen differently by different people, so it keeps people more in control of their consumption experience. I think it's great that email is not a monolith like social media systems. Right, how am I going to convince Facebook to make a change in order to try something new in their system? But we can set up a mailing list server and make whatever changes we like, and people can access it through their own email clients. This also means that the change is less disruptive to users, right? If this particular mailing list is working this way, well, they can keep on using their own mailing lists and their own email clients. So what we want to do is design for receivers. We want to base this in email for control, but we also are providing web access for people who prefer it that way. And we're trying to build a Facebook email bridge so that we can kind of learn about so that we can really test this question of whether people prefer Facebook or email, but we're running into real problems with terms of service. We're trying to steal a bunch of ideas from social media, but also from the things people told us during the interviews. So people are concerned about volume, so we have an option to let them say, I want to receive the first post in a thread, but not any of the others unless I decide to follow it. We want to allow them to tag and upvote emails because a lot of people were worried about spamming everybody. So there was the appeal to this idea of, well, I want to send out this email message but have it only go to a few people. And then if they like it, maybe it will go to more people. Or else, I have this question and I want to answer the, I want the question answered, but I don't want everybody to get it if the first person who gets it can answer the question. So more of these sort of rich ways of controlling. There's also desire to follow specific people and get more of what they're saying, block specific people. There's a very specific person on our lab mailing list who many people would like to block. And some of this may be implemented by, again, in terms of explicit control by the user, thinking about some kind of if this then that type language for describing relatively rich rules for handling email. We also want to design for senders. Another interesting one that came up is various people are afraid of posting to the mailing list, of posting something bad to the mailing list, so they actually want their friends to moderate their outgoing email and send it back if there's problems. This will encourage more participation by these people. And you can try that out at Murmur. All right. We're also starting to think about building a social network for this, but that's so early that I don't want to spend time on it right now. So that's the summary, the online discussion story, looking at richer data models under user control to leverage location and context in content, to explore summarization, or to manage attention and delivery and reception of online discussion. I believe all of these can help improve the quality of online discussion. All right? But as I said at the beginning, I know I only have a few minutes left, text is not the only way to communicate ideas. There's also data. And this is something I've been working on for a long time. This is our Haystack system from 1999. How do we let people say more about the data that they want to manage so that they can record it the way that they like, organize it the way that they like, and share it the way that they want? This has gotten lost on the web, right? In the early days of the web, it was quite egalitarian. The way you put things on the web was you wrote documents, and you posted them somewhere, and that was about it. And so all you needed to know was HTML. In fact, a lot of people didn't even know HTML. They would just take somebody else's document and fiddle with it until it looked like they wanted. So really, anybody could participate. Nowadays, we've got WYSIWYG tools that make it even easier to participate. You don't need to write HTML anymore. You can just use WYSIWYG editors. But what about structured data? We all know that it's very helpful. It supports visualization, sorting, aggregation, computation. Companies spend a lot of money on development to get all of these features. And so you get sites like this, Epicurious. You have templating of items. You have filtering, search, sorting, and rich visualizations. And so there's been the growth of all these data curation sites for recipes, contacts, videos, photos, books, reviews, knitting, housing rentals. Users can contribute data to all of these sites, but they have no way of expressing their organizations, their presentations. Users can't create these sorts of sites. And this is because these sites create a rich data model. The information is stored in databases. You use complex queries to extract it. You template it in various ways. Plain authors can't do all the things that are necessary to create these sorts of sites. So what we've been working on for, I guess, 15 years now is exploring how you can use this HTML language of the web not only to talk about text, but also to talk about data, so that anyone who can author HTML can also author data visualizations and actually, more recently, full-fledged applications. So we've been creating ways to extend HTML to describe data, to describe data interactions, so that you essentially create a complete visualization or a complete application just by authoring HTML documents. You can see that people have this capability sort of in terms of the abstractions because people are perfectly capable of putting data into a spreadsheet and then making a chart of the data by saying which columns of the data should attach to which roles in the chart. And I would say that sort of abstractly, the same thing is going on in an application. You're making a web page and saying which pieces of the data in your system should attach to which parts of your web page. And so in 2007, we created our first language for this called Exhibit. Exhibit lets you create sites like this, which have the sort of the data, the templating, the filtering, and the sorting and searching. It does so by looking at the language. So just like you have an image tag for putting an image into a document, we've created tags for dealing with the data in a document. You have tags for describing that you want a list of certain kinds of data items, or possibly a bar chart or a map. And you just need to bind the view to the various properties that are interesting, like what you want to sort by and what you want to plot by. We also have facets. And here again, you simply want to say how you want to filter the collection. And again, the question is, which properties in the data are desirable for that sort of filtering? And then you have templates for representing the specific items. And this, again, can be described in HTML, where you say which data items you want to fill into which parts of the template. And really, these were all the primitives that you need to describe these sorts of data curation sites. What are the views? What are the facets? And what are the templates for individual items? You put a data set behind that in the form of a spreadsheet or a JSON file, and you get a data curation site. Now, is this general enough? Well, looking through websites, here is Epicurious, and it consists of a site that provides templated items, faceted browsing, sorting, and text search. Here's eBay, which provides templated items, faceted browsing, sorting, and text search. Here's Flickr, which provides the same. Here's CNET, which provides the same. Here's a housing site, which provides the same. Here's the Museum of Fine Arts, which provides the same. So, and here's LinkedIn, which provides the same. So yes, I think that all of these sites are pretty much doing the same thing, and you don't need to program it. You just need to declare what you want, and it happens. So I won't take the time to show you it live, although I can do that later. We put it out in 2007. About 2,000 websites ended up using it. It created a small and active user community. Here are some quick snapshots of exhibits that were created by people. And they look a lot like the content curation sites that I already mentioned. Somebody even made a dictionary, which is a really weird use of exhibit, but okay. Now, you might ask, are really all visualizations the same in this way? I think it's because most presenters aren't too ambitious. Yes, you can very carefully design and build one of these sites, but being able to throw something together quickly is desirable. Also, I think this commonness makes it more powerful, that people sort of know what they're going to see when they get to a website and they don't need to learn how to interact with a new one. So we did a usage study. We sort of gathered in all of these exhibits, found what people were doing with them. We hand-coded a bunch of them, and we interviewed a bunch of authors. And what we found out was that non-programmers do indeed have very rich data models and want to present them in rich ways and create the presentations that they want, and that they cannot find tools for doing so. So again, people were using a clunky research tool because there didn't seem to be anything out there that actually did the job. Some people actually learned HTML just in order to use Exhibit. And in general, people found HTML to be an appealing platform, in contrast to, say, content management systems, which people hate to use, even when they're forced to. They love the fact that with HTML, they're independent of any particular system. They can look at the source code of what somebody else did and copy it into their page, and it'll work, right? So this view source copy modify is very, very valuable. We also discovered, somewhat to our surprise, that people's data models are complicated. They weren't just working with a table of data. They very often had sort of multi-valued attributes, or even acyclic graph-structured data, or cyclic graph-structured data. And so really, a single table is not enough for them. You have to empower people to manage non-tabular data as well. We've carried that idea forward. Looking first not just at presenting data, but also at editing data. We created a tool called Dido, which lets you edit the data that you see on the page. We then thought about how to incorporate computation. And so a couple of years ago, we built a system called Quilt. Quilt said, well, if the data is in a spreadsheet, it might as well be a Google spreadsheet. Sorry. But Google spreadsheets have computation. So why don't we leverage that? Okay, and this is actually similar to what Steve Drucker did with Daniel Fisher, the, what was it called, web charts, that you can sort of use an Excel spreadsheet or something that computes in the back end, and you can bind that to an HTML front end. And now if you edit things in the front, that propagates changes into the spreadsheet. The spreadsheet will compute changes, which can then be propagated back to the web page. And so now you have not only visualization but also and editing, but also computation. This year, we've taken that even farther. We got rid of the spreadsheet entirely, and we basically put the spreadsheet expression language into the web pages themselves. And we've created a tool called Mavo. And with Mavo, you can literally create an entire application with the computation and the storage and the visualization just by editing a single HTML document. Mavo will, and I can sort of show you a little bit of it after the talk because I've run out of time, but Mavo will store your data in your browser or on GitHub or in Dropbox. It will then pull that in when you open the web page. It will populate templates that look a lot like the exhibit templates. But now, in addition to the data itself, you can write expressions, compute the average of the following properties, or if-then type expressions like you have in spreadsheets. And we ran a user study on Mavo, which showed that people who know only HTML were able to create these full-fledged applications in a matter of minutes after they thought that it was going to take them weeks or months. One way we set up the user study was we told people to make an HTML mock-up of a contact manager that they would like to have. When they arrived for the user study, we told them to turn it into an application. And after a short tutorial in Mavo, they went in, they added the little HTML tags that make all of the data alive, and they had complete applications within a few minutes. So I'm really excited about that. So I think that this idea of enriching HTML is a very powerful one. It can let people express without programming, visualization, editing, and computation. What's really great about using HTML is that it is a language and not a system, right? These are essentially proposals for changing HTML. They're not a particular system that somebody has to adopt. I'd like to see this in the browser someday, but for the time being, we provide this all with JavaScript. The advantage is that anybody can see something that they like and copy it into their own page, and it works. Right, so monkey see, monkey do is far better than having to take courses in how to use X, Y, or Z. We've done this through HTML tags, and so for now we're working with people who are comfortable editing HTML source. But since these are just HTML tags, you can use a WYSIWYG editor. And we've prototyped a simple one that lets you just use an HTML editor to create a complete application. So I'm now turning to the conclusion of the talk, which I hope has convinced you somewhat what I argued at the beginning, that people really are talented masters of computation, of information. They know a lot and have ways that they want to organize and visualize and explain what they know. And current systems just aren't expressive enough. We need to enrich the models and the interfaces to let people say what they know. And if we did that, we wouldn't need to rely so heavily on inference computation to figure out what the people are saying. They could just tell us. I think there are lots of opportunities to do this. Now, there's an obvious objection that all of this is too complicated and people want it easy. They want the sort of simple, lightweight, system does what I want. My answer is that the people who want to do something special are the most creative people, and we should be, we'll get more out of supporting them than we will out of everybody else. And so just to make it interesting, I will phrase this as a philosophical battle between the impressionists and the expressionists. Impressionists being people who believe that if you watch the user and figure it out, do a lot of log analysis, keep your eyes on them and apply sophisticated machine learning, you can get your system to work well. I think this poses challenges in implementing good machine learning. It results in mysterious behaviors that users don't want and errors that are very hard to fix. And so I want to stand behind expressionism, where you let the user tell you what they want, and then you do it. And now the systems can be dumb, because they're just a medium for doing what the user has asked. They're easier to understand and control. They're more predictable. And at least we have evidence that some users want them. So in conclusion, here are all of the tools that I talked about. You can try them all. They're all open source, so you can play with them all. One of the reasons I'm here is that I never have enough graduate students, and so I'm always eager to find people who are interested in collaborating on some of this work or related work. But of course, if you know a potential graduate student, I would love to hear from them to help us talk, to help us work on this material. Thank you. Yes, that will work. Yes, you can download it. You can start building your own Mavo applications. Yes, yes. I'm sorry. I had intended to have enough time to show you a little bit of Mavo, but have to respect the clock. Yes?
So regarding Mavo, I was curious where the separation is between sort of the presentation and the model of the presentation and the data, which seems to be the way that we tend to architect these things these days.
So that's one of the fun things about Mavo. Sorry, I'm going to just steal up a few of my Mavo slides just in order to answer your question. So here's an example of Mavo, which I think will make a lot of this very clear. So suppose you want to create a to-do list. The way you do this in Mavo is you write the HTML, that is what your to-do list looks like, and then you just add a bunch of tags that say what your data is. So you never create a data file. Okay? You create an HTML document, and then you say that some of the things in the HTML document are data. So what we have here are properties, right? So a to-do list is a list of items. So you create a list of items. You put one item in it as your example, and you say, what is a to-do item? Well, it is a task, and it has a property of being done or not. And it has some content, right? And then you add an annotation using Mavo saying that you want to have multiple of these, okay? And Mavo now understands that that's what needs to be done with that's the end. That's the whole application that has been created. Let's see if I can show you a picture of the to-do app. Where'd it go? I may have accidentally taken it out. Here it is. Yeah, so this is the to-do app being used. And it's exactly that HTML, plus, of course, a lot of CSS to put in the pretty borders and things. But this is that to-do list. And that was all the HTML that you had to write. And just to contrast, there's a site called ToDoMVC, where everybody who creates a framework can go and show you how you would use their framework to create a to-do list, right? Angular, Polymer, yes, Vanilla.js, everything. So those tools, in general, take several hundred lines of code in order to create a to-do list. And it's code. Like, every one of them, like, you're writing JavaScript in order to make your to-do list. This is all you write for Mavo. Okay? And so coming back to your question, there is no data specification. The data follows from the presentation that you want.
Okay. And if you had, I don't know if this works with a to-do list, but if you had an entity, let's say, that was presented in one way on one page and differently on a different page, maybe with additional details or properties,
yes,
maybe linked, or how does that work?
Well, so Mavo, again, has this data file. And so what you can do is create two separate HTML documents that access the same data file but have different HTML, so different reference to properties and things. And so one of them may have more detail and one of them may have less. This is the sort of, I don't know whether to call it the weak spot or the research question around Mavo, is how to deal with these sorts of schema changes or schema inconsistencies, right? So if the data representation is coming from your HTML, what happens when you change the HTML or when you use different HTML to look at the data? And so there are some things that are very obvious, right? If a property disappears, you don't want to delete it from the data because it might come back later. And so there's certain kinds of renamings and rearrangements that we currently handle with sort of obvious heuristics. But that is the trade-off for Mavos. It's very easy to create one of these data-oriented applications and to extend it by adding HTML. But there are still questions about how to handle sort of people's changes in their mental data model. We've kind of deferred those until we deploy it because we want to understand what sort of changes people are going to be doing before we think too hard about how to support them. Yes?
If I remember correctly, Kindle actually offers something like this where you can annotate your books.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
yes.
some sort of...
Oh, yeah. So,
so can you comment on what Kindle is doing and how...
Yeah, well, so there's actually a lot of interesting work going on in annotation now. Rap Genius, which was originally developed to annotate rap songs, has brought it out to let you annotate, I think, anything on the web. There's a whole project called Hypothesis, hypothesis.is, which is attempting to do sort of a web standardized mechanism for annotation. And as you say, there's things like Kindle. Most of what I've seen in annotation thinks annotation as opposed to discussion. Like, in my mind, what NB is a discussion forum that happens to have anchors into content, as opposed to a tool for annotating content. I mean, Google Docs also, right? I mean, yes, in theory, you can have a discussion on a comment in Google Docs, but you're not starting by thinking about it as a discussion forum. And I think that influences, like, these issues of, you know, reply requested and so on and so forth. It's very natural in a discussion forum. It's a little weird in an annotation context. So I'm sure that with all of this work that's going on in annotation, they're eventually going to kind of, you know, broaden out, catch up, surpass what we're doing. But right now I'm not familiar with, oh, I should also mention that Eric Mazur and some of the other faculty that we sort of experimented with this on at Harvard have started a company to do an annotation discussion tool called Perusall, I think. But I don't know much about it yet.
So in your mailing list project, I forget what that was called, but you gave this list of social media properties that people wanted. But one of the things I noticed was there was no kind of, they were tagging, several other kinds. There was nothing like likes or something else that basically served the same point as the point you made with discussions, that part of the point of those is to make sure that you let other people know where your attention is and that you're reading it. And I don't have anything to say back to you. This is just to say, I read what you posted,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be a very important part of the social media aspect of these private groups.
Well, that's actually very interesting. I've been thinking a lot about sort of, well, the word social. Social media, social grooming. I mean, a lot of what we do on social media is about sort of social grooming, sort of, you know, being nice to the other people, building social capital, so on and so forth. So there are these really two different roles for likes, right? There's, you know, I like you, and so I'm going to like your comment and sort of make you feel good, so on and so forth. And there's, you know, this is a good comment. Other people should see this, right? And so this is another, you know, interface poverty, right? There's no way to distinguish between these two things on Facebook. I think it's very important to distinguish between these two things. And we need interfaces and models that can represent that distinction. You know, I'm interested in sort of creating, this is part of the social network that we're just beginning to scope out. I'm thinking about a less social network, right? One that's more about dispassionate discussion, right? So not an anti-social network, but one which really lets you represent, you know, the quality of the comment, the argumentation, and so forth. And yes, in order for it to be fun to use and to help you build the social, we'll want the social aspects as well, but let's sort of tease them apart.
I think a related question to that, though, is this thing, especially I think in commenting within the case of education, is knowing that somebody actually saw what I wrote, right? And so is there sort of feedback to the person that, in fact, I'm not just shouting into the void? that somebody actually saw the thing, and maybe they don't care, or they don't care to answer, but at least it's being seen.
Right. Well, again, that was one of the real drivers of what people like about mailing lists, is that they don't get a signal that somebody saw it, but they have confidence that somebody saw it. It's actually really interesting what people don't, like, people's mental models are not very accurate, right? So, for example, in the mailing lists, I talked about how people preferred the privacy. It turns out that actually the lab mailing list is entirely public. And in fact, it has 10 times as many people on it as the lab membership. They didn't know this. When we told them, they said, well, it probably isn't, like, it's probably, people don't go looking. People don't, it's not spidered. Like, it's sort of security by obscurity. So it may be okay. But also, yes, people had this confidence that other people were seeing their mail, when, of course, a lot of people had automated filtering tools that were throwing this into folders that they never actually looked at. So I think getting that feedback could be very valuable. And we actually did an experiment many years ago with a content sharing system where just, this is kind of separate from the liking, but sending thank yous to people, like having a thank you button, worked really well to encourage more sharing of content. People really liked a way to say, I've seen this and I appreciate it, without having any kind of, you know, do I like this? Do I not like it? What's my emotion? It's not that. It's just thank you for posting it. That was really helpful.